This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we are joined by Steve Fishman, retired from the EPA, and Matt Riggs from the Mid-America Regional Council. We will be discussing the ins and outs of recycling, food recovery challenge, and more. But first, I'm Natural Lee with your headline news. BismarckTribune.com reports Belle Fourche Pipeline Company estimates that 130,200 gallons of oil spilled into a tributary of the Little Missouri River last week, and another 46,200 gallons leaked into a hillside, the North Dakota Department of Health said Monday. The spill, discovered by a landowner on December 5th, was not detected by monitoring equipment on the pipeline, which is owned by True Companies of Wyoming. The spill has contaminated 5.4 miles of Ashkool Creek, but does not appear to have reached the Little Missouri River, said Bill Seuss, spill investigation program manager for the health department. In addition to the State Health Department, the North Dakota Industrial Commission, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration are also investigating. The WashingtonPost.com reports, alarmed that decades of crucial climate measurements could vanish under a hostile Trump administration, scientists have begun a feverish attempt to copy reams of government data onto independent servers in hopes of safeguarding it from any political interference. The efforts include a guerrilla archiving event in Toronto, where experts will copy irreplaceable public data. Meetings at the University of Pennsylvania focused on how to download as much federal data as possible in the incoming weeks, and a collaboration of scientists and database experts who are compiling an online site to harbor scientific information. To be clear, neither Trump nor his transition team have said the new administration plans to manipulate or curtail publicly available data. Their transition team did not respond to a request for comment, but some scientists aren't taking any chances. In Philadelphia, researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, along with members of groups such as Open Data Philly and the software company Azavea, have been meeting to figure out ways to harvest and store important data. EcoWatch.com reports 1 megawatt of solar power was installed every 32 minutes in the United States from July to September for a record total of 4,143 megawatts of new clean energy, according to the Solar and Energy Industries Association, or SEIA, and the GMT Research's U.S. Solar Market Insight report. That brings total installed solar capacity in the U.S. to 35.8 gigawatts, enough to power 6.5 million homes. Solar power may double from 2015 to 2016, SEIA said. Currently, 25 states have active community solar projects, including Springfield, Missouri. The solar industry employs 209,000 workers in the U.S. In contrast, the oil industry has shed 350,000 jobs as the price of oil has collapsed since 2014. And at this time, I would like to introduce Mr. Craig Lubo, who's also hosting the show with us today. Hi, Craig.
Okay, thank you, Naturally. And as indicated, we do have Steve Fishman here as my first guest. And Steve is retired from the EPA. He was with the EPA for 20 years. And I think you always worked on the Kansas side, is that right? There.
EPA, when we started, was... We had like seven states, and then we went to a standard federal region, right. Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska.
Okay. And Steve was also past president of the Missouri Recycling Association and past chair of the Air and Waste Management Association. He's worked on recycling programs at the EPA, specifically including the electronic recycling, as well as the food recovery program and the Waste Wise program, which is related to the recycling programs. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you for having me.
Let me, if you could start and describe each of the programs, the basics of each of those that you worked on.
Okay. Just to give you a framework, my assignment was to promote sustainability through market development. EPA's Waste Wise program was the overriding structure, helping companies and institutions developing recycling and reuse programs, We helped develop markets for the materials that were recovered, creating jobs and a better use of our natural resources. Two of the programs, as you said, that I'd like to share with you today are our Food Recovery Challenge and the Electronics Recycler Certification Program. Why target food waste? We found it cost about $165 billion annually to manage our food wastes. It's also a big greenhouse gas emissions factor. It's about 14% of all GHG emissions, and 1 in 6 Americans are food insecure. There are a lot of benefits for us to go in and attack this problem. Realizing that food waste is the single largest and least recovered waste stream in the U.S., food waste is 14.5% of the municipal solid waste discards, which is about 215 million tons. That's enough to fill Arrowhead Stadium every day. Out of those discards, we recover only 2% of the food waste. Anheuser-Busch is one of the national leaders in this process. It uses its waste as soil amendments. What we looked at was the life cycle of the food production through production to the end of life. The energy, chemicals, water usage from farm, transit, storage, production, preparation, and service. We found that 40% of all food that's produced is wasted in this process. So what could we do?
And let me get, you said 40%?
40%.
All right.
And that starts on the farm where farmers just identify crops that aren't good enough to go to canning facilities, processing facilities, just left on the fields. There's a little bit of waste in the processing. There's a lot more waste at grocery stores and feeding institutions, restaurants, and one of the biggest wasters of food are citizens. We simply don't know how to shop and store food properly. And at the end of the week when we throw things out, a lot of organics go out, about 15% of our waste stream.
And what's the reason why there's so much waste on the farms in terms of stuff that's not even making it to market?
Misshapen tomatoes. You have pumpkins that are too small, some corn crops. It's just in the processing itself. It's just left on the field.
Is that more because of the aesthetics then, or can this food be unconsumed?
No, the food can be consumed. It's still good food, but it's all aesthetics. It's not number one fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
We also found that U.S. food waste accounts for 25% of all fresh water usage in the United States, enough energy to power the country for more than a week. In wasted nutrients, enough land to feed the world's hungry twice over, and 387 billion calories wasted every day in the U.S. Once we had the data, EPA developed two programs, one for the commercial sector and one for the residential sector. Our initial commercial targets were grocery store chains, university, and stadiums. We developed auditing tools to help identify waste. We did studies to identify the benefits for the participants, and we developed outreach materials. I contacted sustainability directors at larger universities in the four-state region and their sustainability associations. We had some nice successes at K-State, UMKC, St. Louis U, and the St. Louis Cardinals. The only grocery store chain that adopted the program in any meaningful way was Dillon's in Kansas. And one of the interesting things they found was that they were using compactors to manage their waste, but they couldn't see inside the compactors to find out actually if things were being recycled according to the company policies. So they went back to open tops so they could audit what was happening. Some of the changes we saw at universities was to move away from trays in cafeterias and just give the kids plates. They could go back as many times as they wanted to, but they didn't fill a tray full of food. A plate just held less, and it turns out that they didn't need all that food that they thought they did, so they were taking less. We also saw open dining hours, and this relieved the pressure on kids to, I've got to eat all this food because I won't be able to eat later, I may miss dinner, but knowing that they could always get something to eat, they would take less food. This enabled the feeding institutions at universities to donate to food banks, both on campus, because some of the kids just couldn't afford to eat, and community food banks. To prevent household waste, we focused on behavior changes. We developed a Shop with Meals in Mind program, Eat What You Buy, and fruit and vegetable storage guides. The outreach tools were made available to communities. EPA thinks that smarter shopping will save a family about $1,600 per year.
Now, if households adopt these, some of these ideas and cut down on their waste, does that cut down the total waste, or is that just going to leave more food at the grocery stores and on the farms that might get wasted because it's not being sold?
That would be a market reaction, and that's a very good question. I don't think anybody's truly explored that. This program has not had a lot of success. It's still being promoted, so we haven't seen the effects of it yet.
All right.
For more information about these programs, you can go to epa.gov and search for food recovery.
All right. So let's go to the electronics recycling.
Okay. This issue was that when we recover e-scrap, how do we assure that the commercial and public sectors that the e-scrap is properly managed? And it's got to be done in an economically sustainable way. The U.S. generates about 3,240,000 tons of e-scrap annually, and the present recycling rate is only 29%. In 2004, e-scrap was regulated by the hazardous waste regulations, and our export regulations didn't really address e-scrap. So we had a situation where our e-scrap was ending up in Africa, China, India, great piles of materials. People were burning PVC coating and using toxic materials to recover precious metals without any regard to their own human health and the long-term poisoning of their surrounding environment. We were concerned about U.S. firms charging for e-scrap and then dumping them in warehouses or out in fields. So, and even today, we still throw about $60 million in gold every year in e-scrap. To address these issues, we decided to develop a certification program for recyclers to provide a level of certainty so that industry and the public would have some comfort in how their material was being handled. It was a 10-point program. It was called the R2 program. This was a two-year effort of stakeholders that were public, private, and not-for-profit agencies that were all vested in e-scrap recovery. And I can go through those 10 steps if you want me to.
If we can do it quickly.
Okay.
Sure.
One provision was to make sure that the environmental health and safety systems were in place. A second one was a written policy for managing end of life of equipment. The third was how to comply with the legal provisions of the health and safety and the requirements of the local community. Housekeeping standards had to incorporate environmental health and safety programs. The fifth one was focus materials, making sure all downstream vendors were certified. Reusable equipment, how could we go ahead and refurbish equipment and put it back in the marketplace? This was the hardest thing to do because there's a very limited market for recovered or refurbished electronics. The margins just aren't there. But one very successful program is the University of Kansas public radio program that reads to the blind. They get stereo equipment and refurbish it and sell it. Tracking was the seventh issue. There had to be a mass balance, knowing what goes in and what goes out. Data destruction, we had to make sure the data was safeguarded. The ninth was storage requirements, and the tenth was security to make sure that both the data and equipment were secured. It's about $60,000, $70,000 to go through this auditing program, but once certified, then large companies, institutions, and the federal government would be able to use these companies.
All right. And they can go to EPA site to see where they can take recycling?
They can go to the EPA site to get more information, and they can go to Matt's site to identify where to find certified recyclers.
All right. I believe we're ready for our first break, and then naturally we'll come back and introduce our next guest.
This week, hope and fear in the days after the election. We'll take you to a self-defense class in Washington, D.C.
Here! Yes! So your knee is here.
Aimed at empowering Muslim women. Demand is surging.
It's really important to use your voice and be loud and be heard.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before The Jazz Disciple.
KKFI congratulates the Heartland Labor Forum for once again winning first prize for radio shows in the International Labor Communications 2016 Labor Media Awards. Tino Scalisi's Joe Hill's Last Will won first prize for long-form audio, and Tino and Chris Mann won honorable mention best long-form audio for a new crop of women leaders report back from the Midwest for Women Workers and UAW Auto Negotiation No More Tears. Congratulations to Chris, Tino, Judy Ansel, and the whole Heartland Labor Forum team.
Going with the flow on this current cast. You might think that people living in the middle of the United States are very removed from ocean issues, but their actions have far-reaching consequences. It's an interconnected world, so water quality problems in cities and inland areas make their way to the coast. Perhaps conservationist Aldo Leopold summed it up best when he said, "The land is one organism. Its parts, like our own parts, compete with each other and cooperate with each other." Pollution in a watershed can enter streams, travel down rivers, and wind up in the ocean. So protecting our coasts requires everyone's help, conserving water, using less fertilizer, and disposing of waste properly. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Hi, everybody. This is Natural Lee. I'd like to welcome our second guest to the show, Mr. Matt Riggs.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
You're with the Mid-America Regional Council.
Yes, I am.
And what do you do there?
Well, I work for the Solid Waste Management District, which is a section of MARC. And basically, we're a non-regulatory regional solid waste management program, and our goal is to keep stuff out of the landfill. So we do that through recyclespot.org, Recycle More campaign, which we'll talk more about in a little bit. I also wear a couple other hats there. I am the coordinator for the Kansas City Environmental Education Network, which works to expand and improve environmental education throughout the metro area for the K-12 demographic. I also oversee the green team at MARC, and then in my spare time, I am Eco Elvis, the Kansas City Environmentally Friendly Elvis Bebe. That's right. So take Elvis songs and rewrite them to have eco themes.
Awesome.
So that's what I do.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned recyclespot.org, and what was the other website that you mentioned?
Well, recyclespot.org is the one website that we promote for the metro area for recycling information. It basically lists everything that's recyclable, reusable, and compostable in the metro area and gives people information on where to take it. So it's pretty simple.
Okay, yeah, that seems easy. I do want to give out our phone number because you can call in and join this conversation if you would like, 816-931-5534. You can talk to our guests, Steve Fishman and Matt Riggs. Now, Matt, I saw you on the front page of the Kansas City Star, I think, a week ago today.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an interview. Well, they were talking about recycling and mm-hmm. what can go in and what can't go in to uh-huh. our curbside recycling.
Uh-huh.
So I thought I'd get you on the show.
Sounds good.
Yeah, so I was a little surprised about some of the things that I read that weren't supposed to be there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of confusion, and that's one of the biggest problems we have is the wrong stuff getting in the bin. And mm-hmm. that's one reason that the recycling markets are so low right now is that people don't know what goes in the bin. So we have this phenomenon known as wishful recycling going oh. on. And a wishful recycler is someone who knows it doesn't go in the bin, says, I'll put it in there anyway. Somebody will probably figure it out. Or, you know, I really want to recycle it. I'm not sure if they'll take it, but if I put it in the bin, somebody will figure it out for me and it'll get recycled.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that's pretty much the worst thing you can do because on the one end of the scale, you might contaminate the load a little bit, like if you put glass in a curbside bin.
Right.
It gets crushed. It can affect the quality of all the other loads.
Mm-hmm.
If you put something hazardous or liquid in your recycling bin, you could potentially destroy the whole load of recycling in that truck. And the whole thing would have to get thrown out.
Right.
So that's a total contradiction of what that person's intentions were.
Right.
So we really say, you know, if it's not on the list of what that hauler wants, mm-hmm. don't put it in there.
Well, and also don't put anything covered in food in your.
Right.
Now, how do we know who our hauler is and what our hauler wants?
Well, most of the metro area contracts privately with haulers. So they'll be like, you know, say Blue Springs or Lee Summit. There's several haulers people can contract with. So what I suggest is they contact their city, solid waste department, or public works department, which usually has solid waste staff, but public works department, and call them. And if you're new to the city mm-hmm. and you don't know who your hauler is, call them and find out. We also have that information on recyclespot.org on our communities page. If you type Great. In your community, it brings up a list of all the services in your community. So that's another way you can find out, like, who your trash haulers are, if they provide recycling, if they provide yard waste pickup, if your city or county is a member of the Household Hazardous Waste Program, and other basic information like that.
That seems like information that the Homes Association should have as well.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
But I like that recyclespot.org contains that information, so mm-hmm. that's an easy one. All right, well, let's kind of look at why recycling is important for the environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's probably the area where most people focus on when they think recycling. They think, I'm gonna save Mother Earth by recycling. And that's true. I mean, recycling does, it has a number of environmental benefits. It conserves a lot of energy, conserves a lot of resources. It conserves landfill space. It prevents a whole lot of pollution that comes from producing things via virgin resources versus recycled. So it has a lot of environmental benefits, but I don't think people realize that there are other benefits to it, too. And one of the big ones is human health. You know, when you're recycling your can or your paper, you don't think, oh, I'm doing something good for my body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but what I get people to think about is, you know, everything that we use, everything we eat, everything we wear, every gift we give for the holidays has a tremendous amount of resources and energy that go into the production of that product before it ever reaches the store where we buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of pollution. And over time, that pollution affects the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat. So by recycling, you're having a direct effect on your health. And another important aspect about recycling is its economic impact. We just mm-hmm. had a study done, and some of the figures from that is that recycling creates a lot of jobs. It's estimated that in 2015, recycling activities contributed up to 6,250 jobs for
nice.
The 14-county metropolitan statistical area, which resulted in $214 million in wages and $58.5 million in tax revenue to state and local government.
That's excellent.
Yeah, so it's a very big economic player as well. So, yeah, you're saving the earth, but you're also saving yourself and
right.
helping the economy.
Hey.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a win-win-win.
Exactly.
All right, so I think we kind of went over the tips for keeping contamination low. Is there something?
Well, there's a few other tips. Probably one of the biggest is people a lot of times put plastic bags in their curbside bin, or they fill a bag full of bags and throw it in the plastic thing at the drop-off center. Those are not places for plastic bags. The only places that plastic bags And I should say that includes other plastic film like newspaper sleeves, bread bags, the covering that comes on like a case of water. Inside the cereal box, yes. All those kinds of films and plastics, they're accepted at a lot of grocery stores around the area. And a lot of the big box stores like Target and Walmart, they all have a big container usually up by the front door where you can put all that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, so that's one of the big ones is keep those plastic bags out of your curbside bin.
But do recycle them.
But do recycle them, yes.
Yeah, take them to the store. Mm-hmm. Man, I see them floating around outside all the time.
Oh, yeah.
It's the worst. Uh-huh. It's the worst.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's hear a little bit about this Recycle More campaign.
Well, a couple of years ago, we realized that our region was not doing too well. I mean, we've known it for some time. We're behind the coasts. I think the national recycling rate's around 34 to 35%. We don't really have solid numbers here because we don't have any regulations that require people to report how much they recycle. So we have to base everything totally on what we know is disposed of in the landfill. So we know that our percentage is lower than that. So if you're lower than 35%, you're pretty low. Mm-hmm. So what we decided to do was to start a campaign called Recycle More Campaign. So we gave out a grant to Trizola Marketing, and they helped us come up with a great campaign. And the whole purpose of it is basically to get people in the metro area to recycle more. Whether you're new to it, whether you're an old hat, or whether you're somewhere in between. And I think that's where most people find themselves. They do cans, bottles, paper, but as far as anything else goes, they're not really sure. They're pretty confused on what else can be recycled.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the whole center of that campaign has been to get people to go to recyclespot.org. One of the important features of the site, if people get on there, is the what do I do with? There's a section on the right that says, what do I do with? And that's basically an A to Z list of everything that's recyclable in the metro area. So some of our most popular searches and questions that we often get are paint and household hazardous waste. Everybody has paint.
Right.
Every time you move into a house, somebody has left you paint
right
in your basement, and you're like, what do I do with that? So household hazardous waste also includes like stuff like cleaners,
mm-hmm.
yeah, lawn and garden chemicals, pesticides, bug sprays, cleaners, batteries, anything that's the scary stuff that builds up under your sink or in your garage. And, you know, there's places to take that throughout the metro area. We can have it recycled and safely disposed of. Most of the cities on the Kansas City side and counties belong to the regional program. And then on the Kansas side, everybody has their own county program. So there's lots of solutions for that where it can be safely disposed and recycled. As Steve mentioned, there's electronic waste. Well, basically anything that runs on a cord or a battery,
mm-hmm.
from your little wristwatch all the way up to your giant screen TV that's died and lived in your basement since the 1980s, all that stuff can be recycled in the metro area. And it's important for people to know that category also includes small appliances. You know, a lot of times your coffee maker will go out, your hairdryer will go out, your vacuum cleaner, you don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you, oh, it's cheaper to buy a new one than to repair the old one. Well, most people think, well, we just have to throw it away. But it's actually all those small appliances are recyclable well in the metro area.
Okay, so I'm familiar with the hazardous
household hazardous waste.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Household hazardous waste that's up by the casinos in the East Bottoms.
Their facility?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Is there another one besides that one?
Yeah, like most of the cities and counties on the Missouri side are served by that one and the one in Lee Summit.
Okay.
One out in Lee Summit.
Oh, so there's still one out in Lee Summit. Because didn't they recently close a recycling center? But
They closed a regular recycling center, but they didn't close their household hazardous waste facility.
Okay. Yeah. Now, can you take the electronics to the household hazardous waste, or is that a different place?
Normally, that's a different place. There are a couple hazardous waste facilities on the Kansas side that take electronics waste, but mostly that's for the hazardous chemical type stuff.
Yeah. Now,
you mentioned the county programs.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a place that's open all year? Because I know in Wyandotte County, they do that. It's 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. 7 Saturdays per year, and that's it.
Right.
So if you can't get there on a Saturday morning, you can't do it.
Right. Each of the facilities has different hours, different days that they're open. The one with the most liberal hours is the Kansas City, Missouri facility there in the East Bottoms. It's open pretty much every a week of the year. It is closed right now. I think they're doing some maintenance and stuff down there this time of year. But normally it's open every week. Doesn't require an appointment for people who come there. The only thing you have to do is make sure that you are a member community, that you pay into the program. Otherwise, they can't take you down there. But right. That's all explained on our website. I won't get down that far into the weeds. So.
Recyclespot.org.
Right. Uh-huh.
Matt, there's also the Johnson County program, mm-hmm. and that's open, I believe, 5 days a week, and it just takes an appointment mm-hmm. for Johnson County residents.
Right. Yeah, Johnson County residents have, they can take theirs to the one there in Mission or in Olathe. They have two options there as well. So
on recyclespot.org, you lay out information for Missouri and Kansas?
Yes, we cover, basically our services cover the whole nine county area. So if it's a location that's in Leavenworth, Wyandotte, Johnson, or Miami on the Kansas side, or mm-hmm. Platte, Clay, Ray, Jackson, or Cass on the Missouri side, we have it in our database.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And do you provide some kind of education and reinforcing the idea that reusing some of these materials is the ideal, even above recycling?
We try to. The point of this campaign is really to get people to increase just recycling more, because that's kind of where people are at right now. Although we really do try to play up the reuse, especially when people are, like this time of year, when you get a whole bunch of new stuff and you got all the old stuff that you got to get rid of now, what are you going to do with it? Well, some people might think, oh, just throw it in the trash, but most of that stuff, your old widgets, are still good and still usable. So we really encourage people to donate stuff to thrift stores. So that's where I think people really tie into the whole reuse thought stream, right. is through donating stuff to thrift stores.
Sure.
One example I can give, a lot of people probably wouldn't think of, I have a friend that has a lot of cats through her life, and mm-hmm. she used to buy, the cat litter was in these plastic pails, mm-hmm. and she used to take the plastic pails to recycling. Well, I can use those. I take them from her now. Well, they quit doing it in the plastic pails, but while they were doing it, I would take those pails and use them for storage in my basement. And I have like eight of them downstairs right now filled with dog food for my dogs. Mm-hmm. So those come in handy, and that's better. It cuts down. You don't, recycling, you cut down on the CO2, your carbon footprint, but you don't eliminate it. Whereas mm-hmm. when you're reusing it, you eliminate it.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Sure, Craig. That's a good idea. Matt.
Yes.
A.K.A. Eco Elvis. Has he had any gigs recently?
Actually, this morning, Eco Elvis went and performed at Trailwood Elementary School in Johnson County there. Yeah. Had a gig for the kiddos there.
So you sing your songs for the students?
Yes, I do.
All mm-hmm. right. 816, if you want to call in and join this conversation. 816-931-5534. We got Steve Fishman, retired from the EPA, and Matt Riggs from Mid-America Regional Council here. All questions answered about waste and recycling and anything else that you can think of that has to deal with those two things. Matt, I wanted to talk to you about that environmental education. You said there's a program K through 12 that mm-hmm. Mark puts on?
Yeah, it's called the Kansas City Environmental Education Network, and you can get that to it from the Mark, the Mid-America Regional Council site. We've been around since 2003, and our bottom line is to basically improve environmental education in the K through 12 grades, basically to improve and expand it. For all those students. And so we have a group that meets on a monthly schedule, and we talk about not just recycling, but all environmental issues that have to do with schools, which are actually quite a lot. But green schools are definitely gaining some ground. I know that the state of Missouri recently signed on, the Department of Secondary Education signed on to host the Green Ribbon School Awards, which is a national program put on by the Federal Department of Education. So that's really a step up for us, because that can basically mean that, you know, a school that's doing some decent work with green initiatives could win a national award and be recognized at a national level. So that's an exciting development in our area right now.
Now, are there anything going on with schools as pertains to solar panels and any type of grant or anything that you know about that schools can go and?
So, the energy sector really isn't my area.
I just had to
but,
ask.
Yeah, but I mean, there are some, you know, state, like people apply for loans to get it. There are subsidies and other things available to make it more attractive to schools and other businesses. So, you know, I can put people in touch with the right people if
okay.
they are interested in that information. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take our second break, and we'll be right back.
Zorka Millen on Rex Tillerson and Ethan Nadelman on Trump's drug war on Counterspin, Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. On the next Sprouts, Iowans reflect on their lives, their towns, and their environments as the Bakken Pipeline is built through their communities by Dakota Access. One citizen of Ames, Iowa, a map maker, makes the first publicly available map of the pipeline's route as an act of civil disobedience. Thursday at noon.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The best ice cream sundaes are the ones with a cherry on top. But for that cherry to get to the top of your sundae, a lot of things have to go perfectly right.
When you're growing fruit or growing nuts, you are essentially stacking your bets on one of the most delicate manifestations of nature, and that's a flower.
That's Trevor Newman of Roots to Fruits Ecological Design, a landscaping firm in Michigan. He says a few years ago, most of Michigan's cherry crop was ruined after a cold snap came in the middle of an unusually warm spring. The cherry blossoms had emerged early and then froze when temperatures dropped.
Those farmers that are growing just one thing and kind of putting all their eggs in one basket, as it were, they're kind of in a bad situation when that happens.
As the climate changes, winters are getting warmer in Michigan, and erratic weather could lead to more spring freezes. So Newman suggests cherry farmers introduce other fruit and nut varieties into their orchards.
It gives us a little bit more cushion, you know. If the cherries fail, well, we've got a few other things. We're not stacking all our bets on these just this one crop.
That could help cherry farmers stay afloat as the climate changes, so they can continue growing that cherry for the top of your ice cream sundae. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And we're back with Steve Fishman, retired from the EPA, and Matt Riggs, joining us from the Mid-America Regional Council. And you can join us, too, by calling 816-931-5534. Steve, I believe you had a question for Matt.
Yes, Matt. When I was leaving the agency, they were talking about updating the chasing arrow numbers. Have they done anything in that area?
There is an effort in that area. However, a lot of the states, including Missouri, have laws that actually govern that insignia on the bottom of the container. And it gets pretty in-depth, like the Missouri one says the triangle shall be equilateral, that it has to be formed by three arrows with the apex of each point of the triangle at the midpoint of each arrow, rounded with a short radius.
Wow.
Pointing all in the same direction. So, yeah, talk about getting down in the weeds, but it's those types of laws that are preventing them moving from the chasing arrow symbol to what's been proposed as the straight arrow, just a straight arrow around.
Do you see this as a barrier to preventing contamination in the recycling bin?
I don't, because what people need to pay attention to is not the style of the arrow, but the number that's within it. Because no matter what shape it is, if they go to an oval or whatever shape they want, they can put whatever shape, but it's always going to have the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 resin code on that material. So as long as it has that resin code on it, for the most part, it's a good way for people to recycle it. But the arrow is going to be up in the air for a while until somebody decides that that's important enough to change those very detailed state laws. Yeah.
I have another question, Steve, back on the food waste. Is that mostly a problem of distribution? And are the farmers willing to do anything? Because I'm thinking that a lot of those people, that those 1 in 6 that are food insecure, are probably willing to eat that food, you know, that probably are not picky about the shape of their tomatoes.
Right. And there is a gleaners program that's very active in the area, and they work in concert with harvesters.
Okay, and we've heard of that before.
Good.
Yeah.
After the harvest.
Mm-hmm. After the harvest, correct. Mm-hmm. And the biggest problem that we had in getting grocery stores to participate in the program was the lack of dock space and the timing for food banks to pick up the materials, the foods, because they can't keep their docks tied up, and transportation gets to be a real issue because food banks don't have the trucks and the people to regularly get to those docks in a timely manner. And if they need the space, then it goes into the dumpster.
Well, Mike, I'm sorry. Mike also had a question. He wants to know, where do we, or how do we recycle light bulbs? Sorry, Mike.
Can't ignore Mike.
No, we can't.
He's controlling it all over there.
Yes.
Light bulbs are, for the most part, non-hazardous, the ones that most people come across in their daily lives. The one kind that is hazardous is any fluorescent light bulbs, and those can be the tubes like you have out in your shop in your garage, or the little squiggly compact fluorescent bulbs. Those all have mercury in them, and mercury is really not safe at any level in the environment or in the human body. So yes, those are recyclable. You can take them at home improvement stores such as Home Depot and Lowe's take them. You can also take those to your household hazardous waste facilities. Batteries and bulbs plus or whatever they're called now.
Oh, batteries plus. Oh,
batteries plus bulbs or whatever they're called. Yeah,
oh,
they take those as well, too. I know, you know, there's other types of bulbs that people have in their house. Like there's still some that are incandescent or halogen and those types of bulbs. And if you have a few of them, you can take them to your household hazardous waste facility when you're getting rid of your hazardous bulbs, and they may take those as well, because there, you know, there is glass and metal that could potentially be recovered. But for the most part, the ones we really need to worry about are the fluorescent bulbs.
Now, I still don't understand why they made light bulbs with the mercury in them if we know that it's not safe at any level. I mean, if you knock that lamp over on accident, which mm-hmm. I have done, mm-hmm. now we have mercury in the air.
Right.
There is a very small amount of mercury. It's less than a pencil point in those bulbs.
That makes me feel a little better.
Yes. So the hazard level is very low, and it's a transition between the old bulbs that we had and the LED lights, until the LED manufacturers were able to make bulbs at a price point that people could afford them,
mm-hmm.
and educate the public on how much less it's going to be over the life cycle of the bulb, so they'd go out and invest in those. We needed an intermediate bulb at the time to reduce the energy costs. Then the trade-off was in the mercury that was generated by coal-fired power plants
mm-hmm.
was much greater than the mercury exposure from those compact fluorescent bulbs.
I believe that.
So I think the trend is going to be towards the LED lights. They use a lot less energy, I think, and the ones I've seen, they have a lot better light quality.
Mm-hmm.
The prices are going down, so as those continue to go down, they'll go up in popularity. So mm-hmm. that's a good sign.
They work well. They're bright.
Uh-huh.
That's what we need when we need light. All right. Well, how can we help spread the word about better recycling habits?
Well, there's a couple ways. We have a program called Recycle More at Work, which is an initiative geared towards public and private entities, because Recycle Spot is traditionally focused on the individual, but we also, as part of our Recycle More campaign, we really wanted to get out and reach the businesses, the nonprofits, government agencies, schools, churches, neighborhood associations. It doesn't really matter how big or small or what stripe of organization is. As long as it's an organization, this program is for them. And so what we did was we created this partnership, and people can get online on Recycle Spot and join. So if they join, they get their logo on Recycle Spot. They get promoted on our social media what their efforts are. We send them monthly recycling tips. We provide them with recycling awareness materials such as brochures and posters, magnets, that kind of stuff. We'll do a lunch and learn presentation at their place of business where we will give a very in-depth overview of recycling for their employees. And then we'll also do a free walkthrough where we go to their place of business and walk through it and say, you know, your signage has some problems. You need to move these bins here. Basically give them ways that they can improve their recycling programs and follow that up with a written report. So that's one way. But in terms of spreading the word, what anybody can go out and do immediately, every time you have something you want to get rid of, mm-hmm. no matter how big or small, your first option shouldn't be the trash can.
Right.
So if you're sitting there and you're thinking, I wonder if this is recyclable or not, get on recyclespot.org because we have hundreds and hundreds of items listed on there. And chances are we've come across it before. Another important thing that people can do is follow us on social media. We have a great Facebook and Twitter account and blogs as well that we come out with. They have great tips like, you know, what do I do with my plastic bottle caps?
Right. Or, wait, tell us, what do we do?
You have to burn them. No, just kidding. Yeah. You save them till the 4th of July, then you launch them. No. No. Plastic bottle caps. What's that?
Is that what Eco Elvis told the kids today?
Yeah, yeah. It's when all else fails, burn it. Right. That's my main message. Yeah. Right. With bottle caps, one great way to get rid of them is to have, if you have like an old Tupperware container or a butter tub or a Cool Whip container, is to save the lid, fill it full of all the small caps and lids, put the lid back on it, and then throw it in your recycling bin. Because a lot of those are small. They tend to fall through the sorting equipment at the facility. But nice. If you put them in something bigger where they're contained, there's a lot better chance they'll be recycled.
Thank you for that. Because that was not in the article.
I thought if it's the type of bottle cap that's both plastic and with the rubber seal on the inside that you can't recycle those in.
Well, they do allow for a certain amount of contamination. I mean, I know that there's some metal caps that have a little bit of rubber in them and some plastic ones that have a little bit of paper in them. But generally, whatever the predominant material is means it's recyclable. Okay. So a metal cap or plastic cap. And then, you know, like I said, if people want to really get more into recycling, you know, one great place to start is wherever you work, wherever you volunteer, wherever you go to church. Wherever there's a lot of people together, that's where you really get the most bang for your buck in terms of getting that message out. So I really encourage people to sign up for Recycle More at Work. It's completely free.
I like that.
It's completely free, and the things they get and the actions we ask them to do are strictly on their terms, so they can do it at whatever pace works for them. They're not under a deadline or you signed a contract. They're, you know, so it's very easygoing.
Okay.
Works with them. Yep.
So you can just go to... Do you go to mark.org or
recyclespot.org for all this information?
All of it.
Yep.
Recyclespot.org.
Yep.
Uh-huh. Just don't even go anywhere else. Just go to
recyclespot.org.
I like that. So can I sign up where I work? Or
yeah.
I'm going to do that. You know, I got a question for you. Let's say you're at an office and they have a trash can in each office and also one of the blue recycle trash cans in each office. But then when you go outside, you only see a dumpster and then the dumpster for cardboard only. So does that probably mean that they're not actually probably recycling?
Well, it could mean any number of things. Yeah, they could might not be recycling. It might be the janitorial companies dumping it right in the trash if nobody ever told them otherwise. More than likely what it means is that the dumpster out back has an old label on it that says cardboard or perhaps has a different company on it than currently owns that dumpster.
Okay.
So my guess is that they're dumping all that recycling into the one that says cardboard, but nowadays most recycling is commingled.
Okay.
So at most offices and places, they provide you a big 6 or 8 yard dumpster, and in that dumpster goes cans, plastic bottles and containers, paper and cardboard all mixed together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that would be something that someone would need to call that dumpster company that says cardboard only and see if you could actually put, okay.
But if you sign up, I'll come and help you with
that. Okay, see,
that's right.
But if I do that, will you come as Eco Elvis?
I will come as Eco Elvis, that's right. That's one of the bonus Recycle More at Work. You know, I'll come do a lunch and learn presentation as myself, but I will also harass your employees as Eco Elvis.
That's great.
So yeah, right.
I mean, I couldn't ask for anything more. All right, well, is there anything else that you didn't get to bring up that you wanted to say, Steve Fishman?
I was just going to layer on Matt's program. EPA's WasteWise program is a level above that. where you actually do contract and say, I'm going to recycle 5% more a year, and this is the way I'm going to go ahead and do it. Sprint was a national award winner for EPA's WasteWise program. They did a wonderful job of setting up recycling bins throughout their organizations, and they had shadow boxes to show people what went into each bin and examples. So there was no question. And they had a very good recycling rate out there.
That's great. At their headquarters?
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. Craig, did you want to add anything else before we go wrap up?
No, I just want to thank both of our guests for being here, Matt Riggs from Mid-America Regional Council and Steve Fishman, retired from the EPA.
Absolutely.
And so next up, naturally, we'll have the calendar.
The calendar of events, that's right. Thank you very much, Craig. I'll start with how to recycle those old Christmas lights. You don't have to put them in the trash. In fact, you can recycle them for free all year long at Southeast Enterprises, located at 6701 Booth Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri. They're located on 67th Street between Blue Ridge Cutoff and James A. Reed Road, just off of Missouri 350 Highway. Now, you can take them there all year long, but there's also over 100 drop-off locations, one of which may be closer to you. That's not open all year long, but it's open through January. So go to southeasternenterprises.org. That's southeasternenterprises.org. But also, make sure you do check out recyclespot.org, because we spent a lot of time talking about that today, and it has your every need that you need to know how to recycle this, that, or the other, and where to do it, recyclespot.org. Seed Savers KC is having their 2017 Seed Exchange Saturday, January 21st from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Anita B. Gorman Conservation Discovery Center, located at 4750 Troost Avenue. Stand with Standing Rock Benefit Concert featuring Three Sun Green, the North Fork, Grassfed, and Jake Daly. That concert will take place Saturday, January 7th at 8 p.m. That's at the Bottleneck in Lawrence, 737 New Hampshire. And those are all of the events that I have for today. Mike, you got anything else? All right.
Brent Sumner came up with the idea for what became West of the West, Tales from California's Channel Islands, while recovering from a diving accident. He convinced his partner Sam Tyler and Peter Seaman to come on board. The three-hour documentary, which consists of a series of short stories, opens with an explanation into how the Channel Islands were formed.
Tanya Atwater tells us how the islands came to be up here. She said when she tells people that the islands used to be down in San Diego, they think that she's crazy. So she discovered that the tectonic plate shift moved the islands over millions of years from San Diego up to here. And in fact, they're continuing to shift. So to think of it at one point that we would look across and the islands we see here were down in San Diego is amazing to me.
Each of the eight Channel Islands features unique terrain and topography. They dot California's coastline from Santa Barbara to San Diego County.
There's four in the north and there's four in the south. You know, San Clemente, Catalina, Santa Barbara, and San Nicolas are considered in the south and are very difficult to see from here. The upper four are in a line and right on a clear day in our line of sight.
One of the stories told in the movie is the subject of a popular children's book.
The thought of being alone on the island while so many suns rose from the sea and went slowly back into the sea filled my heart with loneliness. I had not felt so lonely before because I was sure the ship would return. Now my hopes were dead. Now I was really alone.
In my research, I came upon this book called Island of the Blue Dolphin, and it turned out to be true. So this island, San Nicolas, that's 60 miles from here, is where Juana Maria had been stranded for 18 years. Now, if you know the story, she was rescued and brought back here to Santa Barbara and died not too long after, 7 weeks, and is buried at the mission. What was fascinating for me is that the archaeologist had been out to the island and been searching for remains or a cave, and they found it. Once they found it, they started to excavate it, and they got right back to about the time that she would have been there, and the Navy shut them down.
The military took control of all of the Channel Islands during World War II, and Navy operations continue to take place today on some of them.
Honestly, the military didn't participate. They refused our request to film on San Nicolas or San Clemente, which we'd love to go back out there because it'd be very interesting to show that side of the story.
Sumner says a highlight for him was spending the day at San Miguel Island with a woman who lived there with her family growing up. Her father was the island's caretaker, and she and her family were the only residents.
The most memorable shoot was when we went to San Miguel Island. It's the farthest north and the most difficult. It's actually considered the most dangerous. It's called the Graveyard of Ships. So for me, that had a lot of mystery. We went there with Betsy Lester, who was raised on the island and left in 1942, just before World War II. So to go there with her, to listen to her memories, to have a tour with her, and to walk to the beach with this 80-year-old woman, to see her childhood, that was amazing. That island's nothing like anything on the mainland. It looks like Cape Cod. You go out there, it's these rolling dunes, this blue glass water, and it's just serene. Now, it's not like that all the time. We were there on a very special day, but that probably was the most memorable.
West of the West offers rich insights into Chumash culture. The Native Americans are the area's oldest known inhabitants. Thousands of Chumash lived in small villages up and down the coastline from Malibu to San Luis Obispo County. Anthropologist John Johnson with the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History is an expert on the Chumash and Santa Rosa Island. He's featured in the movie Story of Arlington Springs Man.
It's very interesting that the oldest skeletal remains in North America were found here in coastal California. And the fact that these bones were found on an island indicates that the people at that very early time period, this is 13,000 years ago, people at that early time period were using watercraft in order to get out to that island, because that was that island was larger than it is today because the sea level was lower, but people still would have needed boats to get out there. The Chumash are famous for watercraft made from sewn planks, boards that they would split from driftwood logs. And these boats were very seaworthy and went back and forth between the islands and the mainland. It looks now to us like these boats, in the form that the Spanish saw them and as we know them today, first began to be built maybe about 500 AD or maybe a little earlier.
If there is a God, he hangs out on this island a lot. The Chumash creation myth is that life started here. And God made a rainbow, and man walked to the mainland. It's an honor and a privilege that this came into my life. It's part of my awareness that is extremely grounding. So spiritually, it's a driving force. I come here a lot in my head. In times of mental turmoil, I just come here and everything is okay.
Rock star Joe Walsh of the Eagles makes an appearance in the film. Walsh has a long connection with the largest Channel Island, Santa Cruz. He's made a commitment to help preserve the island's cultural resources.
Well, Joe Walsh was really the way that this got kicked off. We were invited out to the Feast of the Holy Cross. Sam and I went, we flew over and attended this mass, and at the end of it, Joe Walsh got up and played Desperado, and there was a moment that was a spiritual juxtapose. There was all these people from the islands, and this is very Catholic service, but yet he was singing Desperado, and it just seemed to fit. And for me, that was the moment that everything came together for the film. Plus, we knew we were going to get Peter Seaman because he loved Joe Walsh.
The documentary premiered to a sold-out crowd in Santa Barbara, California, and has been shown on public television stations. For more information, go to thecifilm.com. I'm Lisa Osborne from Pacifica affiliate KCSB-FM in Santa Barbara, California.
On the next Sprouts, Iowans reflect on their lives, their towns, and their environments as the Bakken Pipeline is built through their communities by Dakota Access. One citizen of Ames, Iowa, a map maker, makes the first publicly available map of the pipeline's route as an act of civil disobedience. Thursday at noon.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.